Hi, welcome to New Jersey Academy of Family Physicians, the podcast series. And today we are very lucky to invite Mr. Steve Cremado to talk to us. And he has 30 years of experience as an emergency and disaster behavioral health clinician and educators. He's certified in threat manager, certified master trainer, disaster response crisis counselor, and agency representative. So today we are going to talk more about the wellness, the self-care for our healthcare professionals. So, Steve, that So this environment, we know the current environment is very dynamic and complex, as many people on edge consider sources of stress and concerns. So we would like to listen to your view about that.
Well, thanks, Dr. Lin, and thanks so much for having me here today. Yeah, we are living in a very unique moment in time. I mean, if we look, for example, at a study done this time last year by the American Psychological Association, a survey called Stress in America, this is the highest level of stress in the US adult population they have on record. And it's really people responding to many different sources of stress. It's the residual effects of a pandemic and pandemic fatigue. It's even stress related to the ongoing military conflict in Ukraine and occasionally the saber rattling of Russia, speaking about nuclear weapons and such. Inflation and gas prices. We're coming into a very sort of divisive and active political season with the upcoming 2024 presidential election. And many people actually even responding to climate anxiety related to climate change and things they're beginning to see and feel around them related to the environment. So there's many, many different sources of stress. And those, of course, are not pure types. They tend to influence each other, and people can simultaneously be dealing with all of these. Many people in this report felt that they just haven't had a chance to get a break from what seems to be an unending stream of crises over the last 2 years. So it's a very unique and a very stressful time for many people.
Indeed. And with this environment, we know that our audience, a lot of them are essential trait of healthcare workers. They are used to handle the pressure of work with a high volume of information. They remain flexible in an ever-changing environment. They try to adapt well to the different situation. However, would you elaborate more on the this? We also know that, stress can be good stress, can be bad stress.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you said, there are some traits about healthcare workers in general. And obviously, every one of us is unique and has our own temperament and our own tendencies. If we had to generalize, healthcare workers as a field tend to be more robust and more resilient probably than workers in many other sorts of fields or disciplines. I mean, just given the nature of our work. So as you said, it's a constantly changing environment. People have to be able to adapt to new challenges, new changes all the time. Work with, as we sometimes say, a lot of ambiguity and make, decisions very quickly, while at the same time staying calm. Being an independent worker while working as a team, being able to pinpoint critical issues very quickly and responding, and they have to be very detail oriented. But in terms of stress tolerance, those who work in our field are usually more robust and more resilient in many ways, just by virtue of their temperament coming into this work and the skills they learn as they do the work, they actually become more robust, more resilient to stress. But as you said, there's really two forms of stress. We're talking in a very general way about good stress and bad stress, which are known respectively as eustress and distress. And the way to think about this, I find this helpful, is to think, for example, of good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. We need the good cholesterol to some level. We'd like to eliminate, if possible, if not reduce, the bad cholesterol. We certainly are all aware of some of the adverse effects of the bad cholesterol. But it seems that we need some good stress, this eustress, to respond to challenges, to get interested and motivated, to really get in the zone as it is, to do our very best work. And we know how this affects the brain and the body in terms of increases in blood pressure and oxygen. We know how it gives us maybe, you know, greater strength and greater endurance. So there's a lot of upsides to the good strength. But most of us, when we think about stress, we tend to focus on the negative. We tend to think about the distress because that gets our attention because it's simply so uncomfortable. And this really at a physiological level, as well as a psychological level, is just an overload of our system. You know, we seem to be very well suited to deal with short bursts of acute stress and not as well suited to deal with chronic, ongoing and repetitive stress, or stress that just is cumulative and it builds up over time. And here we see increases in cortisol and endorphins and adrenaline and other stress hormones that can be harmful to us over time, damaging our memory, hurting our immune system. In some instances, enlarging our stomach, it changes how we store fat. So the good stress seems to be, you know, we want to be careful that we don't throw, as they say, the baby out with the bathwater. We do want to reduce stress, but we probably need some stress. It really comes down to our ability to differentiate what is the good stress versus the bad stress, and how do we, you know, kind of balance that. So a lot of, you know, a lot for us to think about when we speak about stress.
Thank you. And I think you are talking about the effect of compound stress.
Well, in some ways, yes. You know, we talked about all these stressors that are hitting people at the same time right now. And as I said, they're kind of cumulative, these stressors, and they also kind of compound and cascade off each other. And as I mentioned, we are very well suited to deal with the sudden, shocking, stressful situation. But what tends to happen when we're exposed to these compound stresses, which can just be exhausting, kind of like being hit by waves in the ocean and never getting a chance to get, you know, back on our feet, is that it wears us down. And the problem here, which is a little bit tricky for us, especially healthcare providers, who I said are more robust and more resilient, is we actually start to acclimate to the chronic stress environment. And while kind of cognitively, you know, mentally, we're thinking about how we adjust and we need to keep moving on and doing our work, our bodies do not necessarily acclimate the same way. And we continue to rate, you know, run sometimes at elevated heart rates, elevated blood pressure, elevated respirations, all those kind of vital signs. And it really has a wear and tear on our bodies over time. So we acclimate to this. We kind of habituate to it, is another way to think about it, in a way that sometimes we don't even notice the effect that this compound stress or chronic stress starts to take on us.
So what you're saying is sometimes we don't realize we are actually walking towards the burnout.
We could very well work towards burnout. But you know what? Burnout gets confused with a lot of different things. So I want to spend a moment on burnout. A really useful way to think about burnout is a form of like emotional callus. Now, if you think about a callus on your hand or your foot, it's a layer of kind of dead, unfeeling skin. It acts as a buffer between you and whatever externally is rubbing you the wrong way. When we think about burnout, it's the same sort of thing. There's something external. It could be our caseload or our clients. It could be our coworkers. It could be the commute to work or all of these things in combination. But things outside of us, external, are rubbing us over a long period of time. And we build this layer of dead cold emotional space, like emotional callus, as a buffer to protect us from these other things. Now, the problem for us in healthcare with burnout is twofold. One, we can't connect with people the same way. We really can't develop that sort of empathic or empathetic connection we need or rapport with people. And the other is through burnout, that layer of dead cold emotional space, we don't read the signs and signals of dangerousness and risk the same way. So it really can compromise our effectiveness. It could put ourselves and other people at risk. Not a lot of good comes out of burnout. You know, while I said there was an upside to some forms of stress, there really isn't much of an upside when we're speaking about burnout.
Yes. And so when we try to recruit the new future physicians, we look for a certain personality trait, for example, compassionate. But we also heard this new term about compassion fatigue. Could you please elaborate on that?
Sure. So, this is a place where, again, the term burnout can be confused with or misused, to be the same thing as compassion fatigue. And compassion fatigue is actually something different. So if I talk about burnout as this kind of layer of protection, this emotional callus that's protecting us, compassion fatigue tends to be the opposite. It tends to mean that our defenses, which can be emotionally defenses, be so exhausted that a lot of the powerful things happening around us, with our patients, with our communities, starts to get through our psychological defenses. They become more porous, and we become more affected. So sometimes compassion fatigue is referred to as the cost of caring too much. And again, it becomes, all of these are unique forms of stress unto itself. And these last few, although burnout is common in many professions, if not most, compassion fatigue is actually more prevalent in caregiving professions and all sorts of places where we're actually, working with human life. So burnout, as I said, becomes another potential weight on our care, on our provider, that really can diminish your satisfaction with your career. It can lead to a lot of self-doubt. It can really, again, deplete your ability to do your job well. But it's a different form. So while burnout and compassion fatigue are really similar, they're not quite the same. They actually are a little bit of two sides of the same coin. One, we're more defended against external stress, and in compassion fatigue, we're actually more vulnerable to sadness and pain and the emotions of other people around us.
Thank you. So, do you want to remind us what would be the warning signs for compassion fatigue?
Yeah, they're a little different than warning signs of other forms of stress that many people are kind of familiar with from daily life. And compassion fatigue, very often you do have a physical and emotional exhaustion, but this could be felt really physiologically with somatic sort of changes, muscle tension, digestive problems, sometimes respiratory sorts of difficulties. It can lead to a sense of hopelessness that, everything is so heavy and so emotionally powerful that we're not ourselves making a big difference or helping people enough. We could be more irritable and impatient and angry with people. We could, again, as I mentioned, feel a decreased sense of productivity and job satisfaction. And in our personal life, problems, really feeling pleasure or feeling happy, trouble sleeping, a tendency to isolate from other people. And in terms of our overall life and our professional life, feelings of self-doubt and reduced self-esteem. So it can really put a dent in the armor of any care provider, any provider, if they are in fact suffering from compassion fatigue.
Thank you. And from we are talking about quality of life for our patient, that is there any advice you can give to us about professional quality of life scale?
Yeah, so actually, Dr. Charles Fegley and an organization known as the Green Cross, Dr. Fegley, now based out of Tulane University, a psychologist there, had years ago pioneered a really interesting tool. And this tool is online and it's free. It's at ProQual, meaning professional quality, ProQual.org, known as the Professional Quality of Life Scale. And actually, what this online tool does, and you can use this as an individual, is rates three different scales, primarily burnout and secondary trauma, vicarious trauma, kind of like, secondhand smoke that we may experience. But it also rates a third scale, which is compassion satisfaction. And compassion satisfaction is the good feeling that we get from the service we provide, even though sometimes it's very, difficult and personally draining. So there's a way for providers to actually go online, do a bit of a self-assessment using this tool to get a sense of where they are in terms of potential burnout, a secondary traumatic exposure, which, as I said, is also referred to as vicarious trauma that we're experiencing through other people's struggles. And then also the possibility of compassion satisfaction, which is motivating us, help keeping us in the field and helping keeping us professionally and personally invested in our work.
Thank you. And certainly we will put this link on our website about this professional quality of life skills. Now, would you advise us how to manage the vicarious traumatic stress?
Right. So the concept of vicarious traumatic stress I mentioned just a moment ago is akin to secondhand smoke. And what I mean by that is you may not be the person smoking, but if you're in a room full of other people who are, secondhand smoke that we breathe can be equally as harmful to our health. In the concept of vicarious traumatic stress, also sometimes referred to as secondary traumatic stress, this means that we are perhaps not a traumatized, you know, the traumatized person. But if we're dealing with patients and, you know, others who have experienced very serious losses, very, you know, very significant hardships and exposure to trauma themselves, this is a bit of a pass along in which we can vicariously experience some of the exact same trauma symptoms, as it were. We could be the person who is feeling the same traumatic stress symptoms as the person who directly experienced it by virtue of our involvement and exposure with them. So, you know, it's important that we know our own baseline, know ourselves, monitor ourselves, be honest with ourselves when we're working with very difficult situations. This could be the volume of our patients. This could be the seriousness of their conditions. This could be the life experiences that they're relaying to you. But to make sure we're taking care of ourselves, take time for ourselves, and when we can, provide buffers and get ourselves away from those sources of stress and limit some of our exposure. But it's really about empowering ourselves and renewing ourselves, really recharging, knowing that some of the situations that our patients bring to us really do have a secondary or vicarious traumatic stress effect on us.
Thank you. How about to manage the burnout?
Yeah, burnout's a slightly different. I hate to say this, it sounds defeatist, but the literature in this area tells us that if you are truly the burned out person, the best thing to do is really do something else for a while, to change things up. This means in general, even if you can't make a big change in the how or where you work or what you're doing, to really start a process of self-reflection and assessment of recognizing how you're acting differently and perhaps interacting with those around you differently. And you may need to make some changes in how you interact, like setting more boundaries, really creating more time for, you know, regular sleep and meals, to just unplug from everything. And I know it's so difficult for us anymore in the virtual environments and all the technology we have that keeps us connected to everybody all the time. But it is a time to unplug from those devices and re-plug in and connect with others around us, to reconnect with nature, to get outside, see the sky, and really kind of recharge ourselves. And also to use our mentors and our peers for consultation and supervision, so we have a sounding board and we know how others are perceiving us, because we may be unaware of exactly how burned out we are until we get some of that feedback from other folks.
So it sounds like we really need to take care of our wellness by design.
Yeah, and what I mean by, you know, what we mean when we speak about wellness by design is it's not casual, it's not accidental, that we build specific strategies and techniques into our daily activities, into our week, that are just for the purpose of, again, physically, emotionally, perhaps spiritually, recharging ourselves in a way that we have enough to actually give to others, and we're not wearing ourselves down to potentially some sort of breaking point. And we could do this as individuals, we could do this as teams in an office, we could do this more informally with a circle of peers and friends and colleagues. But it is helpful to do it with folks who work in our same discipline, because the stresses we endure as providers very often are different than, you know, people working in other sort of jobs who may not be able to appreciate or have the same strategies to suggest about how they may be managing their stress. So wellness by design, as you said, Dr. Lin, really is the process of purposely, consciously making this an area of focus and giving it the time and attention it deserves.
Thank you. So it sounds like the standards for self-care first is to no harm to ourselves in the line of duty when helping others. And secondly, attend to our own physical, social, emotional, and spiritual need in a way of ensuring high quality services for those who look to us for support as a human being.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of the message of that organization I mentioned, the Green Cross, which is an organization dedicated to caregiver and provider wellness. And you know what? As much as that sounds very straightforward and we all could understand that, it kind of runs a little bit against our traditions and our culture. We're almost all of us, if not every one of us, came up through our training and our clinical experience with this idea of patient first, patient first. But if you are not physically and psychologically, well, you don't have it to give to our patients. It's going to lead to a host of problems. So here, as a subtext to the message of, the priority on our patient care, we have to make sure that we are sound, that we are attending to our own needs in order to be available to actually be at the top of our skills, the top of our game in providing the clinical services that we provide. So it is not an act of selfishness. It's actually part of an emerging standard of care that we are putting ourselves first. As I said, that can sound very selfish, especially to people who are raised in the tradition of patient first. But we need to attend to our own health and wellness before we can really effectively provide for others.
So it sounds like you really encourage us to make stress our friends.
Yeah, it's a funny thing to think about because we do think about stress typically as kind of the enemy, right? And here it does make a difference how we think, how we cognitively think about stress. And if we perceive stress to be purely negative, it actually has a more damaging effect on us. There's a really great lecture. It's a TED Talk about, oh, I don't know, 15 or 18 minutes long by Dr. Kelly McGonigal at Harvard, who's a health psychologist. And the title of that TED Talk, if people are able to look into it, is How to Make Stress Your Friend. And it really is about understanding the differences between the good stress and bad stress, about maximizing the benefits we can potentially get out of good stress, and about potentially mitigating the adverse effects of the negative stress. But this is what stress management means. Stress management does not mean stress elimination all the time, because the reality is, especially in our fields, we can't always eliminate all stress. So how do we embrace it? How do we manage it productively and rather take control of stress rather than waiting to see how stress might take control of us?
Thank you. So for the remaining time, I think that if you can emphasize that some skills, some self-care skills on the personal level, on the professional level, and on the supervisory level would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot to think about, and some of this really starts with our own personal wellness. As I said, it means purposely taking time out of our day, out of our week to adopt and maintain a balanced lifestyle. Any one of us, I'm sure any one of us listening to this presentation knows how to get up and in a moment's notice and give a good, description of, a good training on how we should exercise and how we should eat healthy meals and how we should do the right things to preserve our physical and mental health. But there's a real difference if we are actually walking the walk and doing those things ourselves. The number one barrier, Dr. Lin, between healthcare providers and wellness of this sort, this personal care skills, is time. When we look at surveys, everyone knows the things we should be doing, but it is very hard to make the time because it's not just our professional life when we get off duty, it's our family life and all the other responsibilities and obligations we have. So we know those things. We know to balance our life and exercise. We know to get enough rest and about sleep hygiene. We know the importance of staying connected to other people and building these social networks, and not just online, but in real life that we're speaking to people. And we know how to actually do stress control techniques. A lot of people have learned, and we'll talk more about this, I'm sure, about techniques like breathing exercises or mindfulness. Now, all these different techniques, including some things that can be just fun too, like music, taking a bath, really making time to be with the special people in your life, maybe making time to get out for a special meal, something you haven't been able to do for a while, especially, during the pandemic era. So knowing it and doing it are really, really different things. And it's very important professionally that we don't do this alone, that we build peer support networks, that we create environments where we all can be open enough to share with each other's and our mentors when we are having these challenges, when stress might be having a negative effect on us. So people, again, can support us, so they can, again, be there for us. That's one of our, you know, one of our roles is really, because we're in a unique position, to be there for each other and not let any one of our colleagues really struggle by themselves. And of course, you know, this can be translated through supervision we get. It could be through the structure of management in organizations. It could be, you know, really nurturing a team environment or creating a buddy system. But I would suggest that, just like I mentioned, purposely budgeting time in our week for stress control, actually developing an office stress management plan, so it is happening purposely for your whole team and not necessarily just a one-off when one person has the time or interest in stress management.
Great. And so just the fact that our audience are here today to listen to this module, that means that you really pay attention to your self-care and wellness. So we thank Steve for sharing your expertise, and thanks for New Jersey Academy of Family Physicians to develop this whole series of modules.